call this meeting of the Senate Judiciary Committee to order. It is 1:30 p.m. on Wednesday, April 9th, 2025. Before we begin, I want to thank Juliana Singh, the Senate Judiciary Secretary, who makes sure we have a transcript of our meetings, and Doug Gardner. Doug, no, that's not Doug Gardner.
Bridges, sir.
Doug Bridges.
Bridges from the Juno LIO, who makes sure we have sound. At this time, I want to remind committee members and all those in the room to please silence your cell phone. Presently, we have Senator Myers, Senator Tobin, my vice chair, Senator Keel, and myself, Senator Klayman. We have a quorum to conduct business. The first and only item on our agenda today is a presentation on from the Department of Administration's Public Defender Agency presented by Terrence Haas, our public defender. Mr. Haas, if you would please come forward, take a seat at the table, put yourself on the record. You may begin your presentation.
Thank you, and good afternoon to the chair and members of the committee. Thank you for having me here and for the opportunity to speak to you. My name is Terrence Haas. I am the appointed public defender for the state of Alaska and the director of the Public Defender Agency. And my goals in this presentation are pretty straightforward. I just want to give you a sense of the structure, and for those listening out there in the world, a sense of the structure of the agency, how it functions, where it functions, who all's in it, and then a sense using hopefully numbers and hard data, a sense of the health of the agency currently, and also a sense of what our plans are for the future to address challenges that I can see on the horizon. And I'm sure you all will have questions for me as I go along. I feel confident you won't be shy about asking those. First of all, our mission, as it's written and approved, is to provide constitutionally mandated legal representation to indigent clients appointed by the court. I realize that the orchestral music doesn't swell when you read it like that, but in fact, I think what we do is actually quite interesting and quite important. Anywhere in Alaska, in the courts of Alaska, where the government is seeking to confine somebody due to allegations of criminal conduct or on allegations that they need to be hospitalized because they can't care for themselves, or where they interfere with an individual's right to parent their children as they see fit or remove those children from their custody, there's likely to be a public defender there. And it bears noting here at the epicenter of legislative democracy in Alaska that those democratic protections and ideals and constitutional notions would mean very little if there weren't individuals who were willing to stand up, regardless of how unpopular or how difficult, to speak for individuals who face the restriction of their liberty. And so I'll get off my soapbox and down into the weeds here, but that's my pitch for what the public defender does and how important it is in government. This first slide is going to lay out the basic structure of our organization by function. About 83 to 85% of all individuals who are appointed a lawyer, that's referred to as indigent defendants. Those individuals, 83 to 85% of them, are appointed to the public defender. And that's been consistent over time. That's the number of those folks that we have. And we have them in various subject matter categories. There's really three in that area. There's criminal litigation, which includes charges for misdemeanors, felonies, petitions to revoke probation for folks who are on probation, parole. And in some cases where someone is called to testify and might be asked to incriminate themselves, we represent them on those Fifth Amendment type issues. That's our criminal litigation, and that's the lion's share of what we do. And that's our lawyers in the trenches, in court, filing motions, contacting clients, investigating cases, doing the hard work of criminal defense in Alaska. And it's the lion's share of criminal cases in Alaska that we are involved in. The second set of cases that we're involved in are primarily civil, and those involve cases where the Office of Children's Services has sought to remove children or to provide oversight or supervision in cases where there's allegations of neglect and abuse. And we represent typically in those cases one of the parents. Occasionally we represent children in those matters as well, and they're often entitled to representation to have their position argued to the court, and we do that. And then a second category within our civil domain is commitment cases. Those are cases where, commonly referred to as Title 47 cases, where there's an allegation that due to somebody's mental condition or some other status is unable to care for themselves and should be hospitalized against their will. And in those instances, we typically represent the respondent in those cases. The third kind of area where we have a significant amount of representation, I refer to here as post-conviction, although it could just be post-judgment in a China case. Those are cases where we're bringing an appeal on behalf of somebody who's been convicted and sentenced or been given bail that they disagree with, and it's the final bail order. That's a whole set of appellate practice that we do, and we have a whole set of lawyers that do that. And then there's another area called post-conviction relief, which is a kind of civil practice where after you've been convicted, you can collaterally attack the judgment in that case by essentially suing the government in a civil case, which is called a petition for post-conviction relief. We provide lawyers in all those areas as well.
I have a quick question about the post-conviction relief. My general sense is for the first first few decades of statehood, the Public Defender's Agency had very, very few post-conviction relief matters that the agency was handling. And at some point, and in my limited world, sometime from, I'm guessing, the mid-90s or maybe a little later, all of a sudden, at some point, the public defender started taking on a number of post-conviction relief matters, and now you have attorneys, that's all they do.
That's right.
When did that change, and why did that change?
Thank you for the question, Chair Klayman. That reflects, this is partly, I'm not guessing, but this is partly me operating on kind of my general knowledge of criminal justice. That represents a shift across the entire criminal justice system, federal and state, over that time period. Post-conviction relief matters became a much more common way to essentially work on your case post-conviction. As merit appeals somewhat shrank and as the appellate routes across a lot of state systems and the federal system were restricted more, then you had an expansion of the use of this, what at one time was a relatively rare procedure, has become more common everywhere. And Alaska is among the places where that happened. And I think we always were responsible for taking those if someone requested a lawyer and one was appointed by the court. So the short answer is there's just more of them now.
Thank you.
Thank you for the question, Chair. The fourth domain that I have here is our administration. That's the smallest of our, as far as our lawyers go, and those are the folks who do the management, the legislative communication, communicating with the Department of Administration where we're housed, doing our budgets and accounting and record keeping, which is of course a big deal for a criminal defense organization. And then I put last on there, that last bullet is AmeriCorps and holistic defense. That's a still relatively new concept that we're attempting to expand. And that takes some administrative energy to do the grants and the like that have to be administered for that. And that's kind of a basic outline of our structure. To give the members of the committee a sense of how each of these fit, this is a pie chart showing in absolute numbers the number of lawyers at the time that this was created, maybe a little bit stale at this point. Of the number of lawyers handling each of these subject matter areas. And as you can see, you know, we're most famous probably from procedural police dramas. We're the lawyer you get if you cannot afford one. And that's mostly what people know about the public defender. That's really what we mostly do. That's 90 lawyers at the time that I created this chart. Then 20 lawyers are handling family defense and mental health matters. So those are used to be called our civil division. I've started referring to it as our parent defense division because that's really what they do primarily is defend parents in China cases. And then we have 15 lawyers who are in the post-conviction section. That's both appellate lawyers and PCR practice. And so that's the smallest number of lawyers, although they handle a significant volume. And then finally, there's just 5 lawyers that are assigned to our administration. And those folks...
Senator Myers, go ahead.
Thank you.
I think you all on the committee know that when we get lawyers in front of the committee, we are much more happy to interrupt. since both the Public Defender House has been both an advocate but also served on the bench, he knows that interruptions are part of the package.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I wasn't sure exactly where you were going with this, but it does strike me as odd that what we have listed as administrative functions, you're saying that we have attorneys assigned to that, other than drafting of legislation, I don't understand exactly why you would need attorneys in that section.
Through the chair, Senator Myers, I appreciate the question. That was a pretty short list that I had on the previous slide. Mm-hmm. What I'll tell you, first of all, is that all of those lawyers at this time also handle litigation directly and in the trenches. In fact, I myself have been doing misdemeanor trials with new lawyers because we need people to train lawyers. And so they're all doing a certain amount of that as well. They're broken up by, there's a deputy for the criminal stuff, there's a deputy for the civil matters, there's a deputy for training and development. That's somebody who's doing our recruitment and who's helping to get our new lawyers trained, of which we have very many right now. Mm-hmm. So it's broken up. Then we also have an attorney that handles purely just the administrative work. So that's communicating with the Department of Administration, communicating with the legislature, so on and so forth. All of them, as noted, do handle day-to-day casework as well. And they're really, what they're doing is, for instance, the criminal deputy has to figure out how to get all of the work distributed evenly across the state and to do so in accordance with my directive that in every instance possible, somebody has a lawyer in the place where they're at. And that lawyer, to be the public defender's criminal deputy, means appearing constantly in court to answer questions from irritated judges and to talk about conflict issues and so on and so forth, which is another big piece of what these deputies do, which is work through conflict issues to figure out how to get cases where they need to go. I hope that's helpful. That's just a short example, but to give you an idea.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Myers.
Senator Chair.
What is going on here? Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I want to ask a little bit more about the Child in Need of Aid cases and its relationship with ICWA. I myself am a little bit murky about some of those dynamics, and I hope that you can kind of expound a bit. Are we providing support to tribes? Are we providing support to the biological parents? What does that look like?
Through the chair, Senator Tobin, I very much appreciate that question. I practiced in Bethel for about 10 years and then was a judge there for about 5 years. And the China cases out there are almost exclusively ICWA cases, which for the uninitiated is the Indian Child Welfare Act. And those are cases controlled by the federal law related to children who are tribal members who are taken into state courts and taken into often into custody by the state. The short answer is yes, we're always working on ways to work with tribes to figure out that rather complicated and thorny question of what's the role of the tribe versus the role of the Office of Children's Services, what is the role of the advocate as between those organizations. It gets very complicated. And sometimes we're aligned with tribes, and sometimes we're not aligned with tribes, by which I mean the client we represent likes or does not like the tribe's position. And so that's all, as you can imagine, very complicated. On the other hand, we're a strong proponent of getting resources to tribes to help their tribal members tackle the issues that give rise to these China cases. So we're always looking to participate. We don't have anything as direct as working with tribes in their own courts or anything along those lines, because we only operate in state courts and our enabling statute only permits us to do that. But we do communicate routinely with tribes, with ICWA workers, in an attempt to resolve problems. And on the previous slide, there was something about holistic defense. That's one of the big focuses of holistic defense in the Child in Need of Aid arena, which is to come up with ways to help people with all their problems, not just their legal problem. And you can imagine for my lawyers, it's often frustrating because we show up to court, we argue a legal case to a judge, we get some case resolved, and we've at that point addressed almost none of the problems that our clients have, because most of their problems lie elsewhere, poverty or all the various criminogenic factors that you hear about elsewhere.
Senator Tobin.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I agree. I struggle with the concept that often is called mandated supporting, that there are so many other factors that contribute to someone being in front of you or needing your services. But I know that you might address this on another slide, and so I just want to ask the question here and feel free to punt it for an additional slide, which is really around the caseload, the new lawyers that you're bringing on, the mentorship, and the complexities of Alaska ICWA Child in Need of Aid. And what you see is the time horizon it takes for folks to kind of get their feet underneath them and understand the complexities and be able to go flourish on their own. And if there's a high churn and burn that we see from that particular, those folks who are focused on that particular area of the law.
Through the chair, Senator Tobin, I am getting to that, and I will defer it just to stay structured, but you're hitting on something which is at the center of our challenges at the public defender going forward. This next slide just gives you a sense of where we're located. We're all over Alaska, obviously, from Utqiagvik in the north, where we're struggling to recruit, but I think we have some prospects, and we'll finally have a lawyer there, I think, after a very long time. We're very focused on that, all the way to Ketchikan and Kodiak and everywhere in between. When you look at this map, one of the things I think to keep in mind about the agency's priorities and my priorities as its director is that Anchorage is by far, if you look at the attorney PCN numbers, is by far our largest office. And having spent a lot of time in the bush in Alaska, one of my first priorities when I took over was to get focused on how to keep resources where the people are, because it's always going to be easier to do things in Anchorage. It's easier to get a desk into an office and to get a person to agree to be there, and it's a little bit cheaper to pay them and so on and so forth. And so these numbers reflect, I think, that reality. There are other big offices. Fairbanks, of course, is our second largest office, but Palmer is right there. And of course, Bethel, Juneau. There are several large offices around the state. And my goal going forward is to continue to improve the way we give resources to those offices to meet people where they're at. And that gets directly to Senator Tobin's question about Indian Child Welfare Act issues, which is to say we have a certain number of those folks in the city and a whole lot of those folks out in the bush. And how we meet their needs is partly a human problem. How do we get people to where those folks are, especially in a difficult job market?
Wait, Senator Myers has a question.
Oh, sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you're mentioning Anchorage is your largest office. A lot of when the public defenders have been in the news the last few years has mostly been about caseload. Mm-hmm. There's been some talk around here lately, though, of giving you guys the possibility to be public defenders in municipal cases in Anchorage. I'm less worried about the budget side because it sounds like we're working on receipt authority for you. But how is that going to affect your caseload if you're going to be – you're effectively already saying that overloaded, but now we're going to be taking on even more cases with the attorneys you have?
Through the chair, Senator Myers, that's an excellent question, which, believe it or not, I did anticipate the possibility that we would talk about that. Let me skip over a few slides here and get you to a spot. I skipped over the slide about our budget, which I will point out has steadily increased, largely due to increased salaries for attorneys. That's the lion's share of what that is. But it's also given us the ability to contract and to address this backlog problem. I often say, I can't remember who said it. It might have been Churchill said that a rumor makes its way halfway around the world before the truth can get its pants on, which is to say that period of difficulty at the agency will be the thing we're talking about well into the future. But that, in fact, we've made great strides in this area. This slide shows you some numbers related to appointments coming in, disposition rates for cases going out, and the actual number of open and active cases that we're carrying. You'll note, and I'm sure the court system, I'm sure Nancy Mead has probably brought this up elsewhere as well, the number of filings, and so has law, I think, the number of filings has gone down. That's what appointments is. Uh-huh. That's the number of cases to which we are appointed. It was at a high in 2020 at 22,000, a little over that, and a little less than 17,000 in 2024, and continues to drop like that. So we have less cases coming in the door. For those of you who took calculus in high school, less water going into the pool at this point. And then you look to our disposition rate, which has been a real it's been a priority of mine. It was a priority of mine on the bench, but it's also in a very different way and with a different set of concerns, a priority in the role of public defender. And you'll see we had disposition rates in 2020 and 2021 of 91%. By way of explanation, a disposition rate of 100% means we get as many cases in as we have going out. So 100% is even. Anything above 100% means we're shrinking things. Anything below 100% means the caseloads are getting bigger. And you can see in 2020 and 2021, we were well under 100%. That means that caseloads were growing. And actually, a 91% overall disposition rate is quite low. That means that things are growing fast. Then starting in 2022, it jumped up. And it continues. It continues to go up. It was a little bit lower in 2024, I think, reflecting probably some low-hanging fruit. But I show a disposition rate projected for this year. We only have two quarters in, but I show a disposition rate of a projected one of about 110%. So that's as high as it's been. What that means is that our caseload should be shrinking because more cases are being disposed than coming in the door. That's partly from dropping appointments, but also partly from more efficiency on our part. And that bears itself out in the open and active cases quite clearly. You'll see that in 2021, we had over 14,000 open cases. And this is on January 1st of any given year. On January 1st of this year, we were all the way down to 8,936 cases. And during that same time period, our vacancy rates, which were on the a few slides ago, have continued to go down. You'll forgive me, I'm looking at an actual little book. I know I have a teenage son. If he's watching now, he's rolling his eyes. My apology. we have a vacancy rate all the way down now to 8%, which is I'd like to get down a little bit lower, but that's really significantly better than, for instance, in 2022 when it was all the way up at 14%. And with our continued policies and our goals right now, we're bringing those cases down. So that addresses, Senator Myers, through the chair, that addresses the question of our caseloads getting better. They are. But the question about why take on more work is a more complicated one. And I would say that it's like it is in any industry where you have a complex task to do that requires experience, knowledge, confidence, and in the case of being a criminal attorney, independence. I can't talk to all of my lawyers about all the decisions they make for all of these clients, almost 9,000 of them. And so I have to trust folks to be able to exercise independent judgment, skill, knowledge, and so on and so forth. But right now, that period, that outflux that resulted in those high caseloads and high vacancy rates, that was mostly our middling level attorneys leaving. Those are the folks who do a lot of the supervision and have a lot of the knowledge that they pass on directly in the trenches to the lawyers that work with them. So this would be the functional equivalent of the position I'm in Anchorage, where we didn't have any misdemeanors. It started at felonies. You wouldn't hire, let's say, a brand-new engineer, just graduates. I went to Purdue, so we'll say Purdue. Graduates from Purdue, walks out the door. You wouldn't have them design and oversee the construction of the Brooklyn Bridge. They're not there yet. And any attempt to do that is going to be more detrimental than helpful. Well, I've got a whole lot of brand-new lawyers who have just come out of law school. I'm going to have many more in the coming months because most of the lawyers we're hiring are mostly, you know, they're brand-new. They're going to get out of law school. They're going to have to pass the bar, and they're going to have to learn how to practice law. And so while it may seem counterintuitive, part of the key, I think essential, vital to our ability to continue to improve our disposition rates and the system of justice generally is going to require us to have those kinds of cases. Those cases where you can try many of them, where the stakes are lower, where you can learn to practice law. Without that, what you get are brand new lawyers who become, verklempt. They lock up. You know, because there's the stakes are so high and their knowledge is limited. And then their caseloads start to grow. It's like a snowball. Now you're not moving cases. Now not only do you have cases that are difficult for you to handle, but you have too many of them. And they're complicated, and you need help figuring out what the answers to the questions are that your client has. And so the short answer is we needed to train lawyers, and the city needed someone to represent defendants. And for the uninitiated, it is not possible to proceed with prosecutions, at least in the United States and in Alaska. It's not possible to proceed with prosecutions without a lawyer. And so we're a vital part of the process going forward and justice getting done for everybody involved. And so that's the kind of long-winded, but that's the basic answer.
Okay.
Senator Myers, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to note that while we do occasionally hear some Latin around here, I think this is the first time I've heard the word verklempt used in the legislature.
Through the chair, thank you, Senator Myers. Always my pleasure to improve upon our diversity here.
It won't be the last Yiddish we forgin you.
Going back to slide 4, just so that if I look at the bottom, Sitka has one attorney PCN starting in 25-0, still recruiting 4-0. Uktyavik has one PCN, 0 starting and 1 recruiting. What does that mean in terms of on the ground? Does that mean there's no attorney? Yeah, what does that mean?
Yes. Thank you, Senator Klayman. And so it's I have to say, in every presentation I've done, the most difficult thing is to communicate this information, and it often causes consternation. Obviously, the office is obvious. That's a geographic location. The attorney PCNs are the number of PCNs assigned to that location. Starting in 2025, that's the number of spots that the number of lawyers we've hired for that location but who have not yet arrived. And lawyers typically, I grew up in Indiana, so it's kind of like farming. You know, you do a bunch of work and then you wait around and see what happens. And so we're waiting around to see what happens, but we're pretty confident that those folks are going to show up and take those spots. Still recruiting four are the number of open spots for which we do not yet have an attorney. Across the system, that's a total of 11. We have hired for seven. And we have, I can say confidently, we have many more prospects than that, but those are folks who have signed on the dotted line and are showing up.
So if I'm looking at the chart, does that mean Sitka you're not recruiting for and not starting because you have somebody there?
We have a lawyer there. That's exactly right.
Uktiavik, in contrast, there's a position, but nobody's there, but you're recruiting for them.
That's right.
And then if I look at Nome, they've got three PCNs and one recruiting for it. Means you've got two in place.
That's right.
And one position.
That's correct.
Okay. Thank you.
And Uktiavik, while we're on that topic, is actually emblematic of the struggle, I think, across Alaska, but the public defender has had this struggle in particular, which is that's a community that deserves to have somebody there working on those ICWA cases, but also just in general being part of the community and reflecting Alaska's commitment to the community. It's been very difficult to hire there, and the result at the public defender, predating me by a bit, but for a very long time there just wasn't someone there because it's easier to handle that out of Fairbanks than to get to find the right person for Uktiavik, which is that's a special person that wants to go do that. But they're a person I want to find. And so, and I think we're going to be able to here in the next year. I think I discussed shortly the budget, and I just want to make clear, I haven't requested a supplemental this year, and I have no other asks for the coming fiscal year other than what's already in the governor's budget. And the reason for that is because we've been well supported both by the legislature and the administration in a way that allowed us to contract for those cases that were affecting our backlog, and in a way that allowed us to start recruiting in a meaningful way. The increase in the salaries has done a great deal of good. We're now very competitive as positions go for public defenders. We were also in a position to address workload. It takes a little while for attorneys to get comfortable, but during the time that workloads got so high that there was some concern about whether the agency could even continue to take cases, that has a really detrimental impact both on the lives of the attorneys doing this very important work, but also on the work culture over time. And so we're kind of getting out of that at this point, and those resources made that possible. I already went over this slide, and I'll just point out. I mean, I think it's the high disposition rate, but also notable within this is that our conflict rate has stayed steady and it's actually dropped. So I show right now a projected conflict rate for 2025 at 2,904, that's actually down from the highest I've seen, which is fiscal year 2021 was 3,803 conflicts. For the uninitiated, those are cases that will go either to OPA or to a contractor to be handled. That rate has been consistent as a percentage of the total cases coming in has been consistent for years. I hope to bring it down. It's actually part of this misdemeanor program that I'm trying to get funded, which is through receipt authority. I'm not asking for anything from the state for that. Which is that it allows me to do, we have pioneered it. It's a small group of cases, relatively speaking. We've pioneered it to be conflict-free. So it does not, it's conflict screened for the rest of the agency, and it will have two units which are conflict screened as to one another. And this should allow it to handle all of its own cases without sending cases to OPA. Any that remain after that process would be contracted through funds received by the city. But the point of that in the long term is that if we can demonstrate that can be done efficiently and effectively, coordinated conflict process could make a huge difference in the efficiency of how we do things. If you talk to any judge, one of the frustrations that they will tell you is that it's very difficult to have late declared or caught conflicts, and it's very difficult to wait around for these two totally separate agencies to coordinate moving defendants and cases from one agency to the other. And my hope in the long term, it's not tomorrow, but my hope in the long term is to demonstrate an ability to coordinate that process that's both better for clients, but also better for state government, because the amount of duplication and the amount of inefficiency created by these two totally separate administrative processes is pretty significant. And so that's actually another thing that we're working on with this municipal project.
So what are you essentially trying to create within your agency, essentially a separate firm within the agency that allows that firm to take on somebody that would otherwise be conflicted out and sent to OPA, but instead it's technically assigned to the public defender, but because this is a separate entity within your agency, all the files are kept separate, so they're essentially independent, and they essentially remove the conflict by being a different firm.
That's right, and the way so OPA already does this, but it does it in a way that's different than how I want to do it. I want to the greatest degree possible to retain the benefits of a statewide agency, which are significant, I think. But to also create the ability to have conflict screened entities in the private market, this is done pretty routinely. Large firms, of course, would have difficulty operating internationally and nationwide if they were not able to create these kind of conflict screening procedures that allow you to represent folks. But the biggest benefit is that right now, public defender has all the administrative machinery to do conflict checking and record keeping and all of that, and OPA has a totally separate, completely different set of machinery to do the exact same task. And then because they're totally separate entities who aren't able to communicate and coordinate in the same way, you get a lot of friction around how to get cases to and from where they belong. The end goal, of course, is to have a conflict-free lawyer in every case and to do it with the greatest degree of efficiency and to the benefit of the client possible. And I think, in the end, we'll be able to do that in-house maybe more effectively. That's long-term, but I think with this municipal project, we should be able to demonstrate its workability, I'm hoping. This next slide relates to the challenges that are associated with the future for us. The biggest one is the one I've already stated, which is a loss of a lot of our most experienced attorneys. One thing to note is that we have a hunk of folks who are going to be leaving now, who are the last of the defined benefit employees. And each time the legislature and the administration raised the salary, that let us hold on to them a little bit longer because they needed to stay a little bit longer to reach the calculation for the high three, as state employees call it. But that group is hitting retirement here fast. And so we're not going to have those folks anymore. And as I described earlier, we lost a big hunk of our folks in the middle. And really, those folks in the middle are the life of the organization. And so task number one for the future, not just for the public defender agency, because anybody I train, we will keep, on average, about a third of the lawyers that come through that we train up. Two-thirds of them, on average, over time, will move on to other roles. They'll become prosecutors. They'll become attorneys general. They'll go into the private market. And so we're really training everybody's lawyers in a way, which is the way I like to think about it. And so that's the key. That's kind of the goal for the future. And for Alaska, it's especially urgent. It's true all over the country, but for Alaska, where we have no law school and no other mechanism by which to create lawyers, we have to create experienced lawyers ourselves for the most part. Most people don't come to Alaska late in their career. They come for an adventure at the beginning, and then we try to talk some of them into becoming Alaskans indefinitely, which many of us in this room, no doubt, were made into Alaskans in that fashion. And so that'll be what we're focused on. A second one is discovery. With the rise of technology to produce discovery, we receive many, many, many gigabytes of information. As we sit here, as I sit here speaking, there are gigabytes of information being transmitted from police databases and from the district attorney's office into the public defender database and then attempted to be downloaded. And because that change happened at such a rapid pace, we haven't really adjusted for how do we deal with that. A lot of our processes and procedures remain affected by how we did things in the paper world. And so not just the public defender, but state government in general is trying to figure out how to grapple with that. But it's a tremendous cost, both in terms of time, in terms of the cost of storing the information, and the cost to an attorney in time, and anyone who's been an attorney who's had the fortunate experience, I will say, for this purpose of being an attorney, will know that that your time is your biggest resource. And so the amount of time spent downloading something. You'll hear this from the Department of Law, too. Hear this from everybody. You know, sitting there watching a recording download just to discover that it's an hour and a half of somebody driving around. And then you go to the next one and download it and review it. And, of course, the availability of the tool to record means that enormous amounts of information are recorded. It is not uncommon for an officer to, in the cases that I've most recently been handling, which are municipal cases, but this is the same process everywhere, it's not uncommon to get a full 45 minutes or an hour of nothing happening leading up to the event that constitutes the event that makes up the charge. And that's a lot of information, a lot of time. And we are working with law.
Senator Myers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you mentioned law when they were here a couple weeks ago. I kind of asked them a similar question. Is the gigabytes of data, this is an issue across the country. I haven't really heard a whole lot of problems, longer case times, anything like that from other places around the country that are dealing with this as well. Is there something else happening, other procedures in other states that we could learn from?
Through the chair, Senator Myers, first of all, almost certainly there's more we could be learning. I do think that it plays some role in pretrial delay, the amount, the quantity. Probably more significant in pretrial delay is the coordination between the agencies and then between the public defender and its conflict relationship with OPA of the movement of those files from one place to another. One enormous efficiency that I'm working on with law is to come up with a way to stop creating additional copies of everything. The way it's working now is we don't have a shared database system of any kind. So the police make a recording. It's 150 gigabytes. They upload that to one of several products out there that hold those. Then the district attorney will take that and give us a link. We will then create a totally separate copy of all 150 gigabytes, which will then be sitting on a server for us. Then if that relates to a case involving a lawyer in another location, chances are they're going to have to figure out through Alaska's somewhat more difficult bandwidth to download that to themselves, so on and so forth. And so we're doing a process which is duplicating the material, sometimes several times. That alone, if we can figure out how to coordinate with law and with the Office of Public Advocacy on that question alone, we'll save tremendous amounts of data and time. But that's a long-term project. It's not easy. You know, there's so much information already in a system somewhere that we have to worry about.
Okay.
I appreciate the question. And do keep stopping me as I filibuster here. And then I listed pretrial delay as a significant issue that we face. And, you know, that's an extraordinarily complicated problem. The Supreme Court has issued an order as relates to much older cases. These are cases, I believe it's maybe 2022 and older, a time frame in 2022, which is designed to push those cases forward and to limit the number of continuances, so on and so forth. But the problem is going to always be more complicated than that. We're not going to try cases where there's not a lawyer ready to try them unless we would like a bunch of appeals and PCRs and, you know, the kind of process that slows things down yet further. And so that's a short-term solution to some of the cases, but the long-term solution just takes us back again to that recruitment and training question. I have to have lawyers. My biggest problem right now in terms of trial delay is having enough lawyers experienced enough to try the most serious cases. And you simply cannot give those to a new lawyer. You can only give those to a lawyer who is experienced enough, has enough time under their belt, enough experience, and has demonstrated enough proficiency to handle those cases. Any other outcome would be unjust to the defendant, but would also create all kinds of problems in the system down the line. And no amount of court order, no amount of hand-wringing will solve that problem for me. I have to get the lawyers. I have to either train them or assign them, get them lined up, and make it happen. It's going to be hard work. But it is it is the problem of the moment, which is, you know, how do we tackle pretrial delay?
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Haas, as we look at the efforts the court system's making and listen to the Department of Law talk about their efforts to work through these backlogs, I don't necessarily have the technical skills as I read the court's orders to know, to have a sense of whether they are pushing too hard to get things to trial, whether there are situations where a defendant truly needs a continuance and it's in the interest of justice to do that versus cases potentially lagging for years and years and years. Where are the concern points for you with the degree of pressure and the degree of change in the court's, not technically court rules, but the court procedures?
Through the chair to the vice chair. That is the question that faces us. In my experience, lawyers don't always read things the same way. And so this is a relatively new order from the Supreme Court relating to the number of continuances permitted by each side before a case must proceed to trial. How we're going to read that order, it has some new language in it, for one thing. It talks about I'm trying to remember the exact word, but it relates to the only granting continuances under extraordinary circumstances. That might even be the language. But we don't know yet for sure how judges are going to apply that or what they're going to think about it. My primary concern in representing the Public Defender Agency, but also on behalf of my clients and as a member of the defense bar, is that we figure out a way to be as orderly and as fair as possible in how we do that. It is rare in the implementation of a process of criminal justice that bright lines can be maintained unless we have judges and other participants in the process looking carefully at the specific circumstances of that case. And in law, that is always the tension between the general rule that will be the bright line rule in every instance and the specific idiosyncratic facts that relate to this individual person. And I would say for me and for my lawyers, the biggest anxiety is whether or not courts will enforce these rules in a way that ignores the specific idiosyncratic concerns of the case in an attempt to just get it tried. When I was, from a different perspective, when I was on the bench, it was always my goal to create, and I will say I don't know that it was always popular. I won't speak to my popularity in the defense bar as a judge, but I will say that it was always my goal to create an orderly, predictable process that gave people as much notice and as much time to understand where they fell in the line of cases and what they had to be ready to do. And the analogy I always use is chopping wood. Like when you get up in the morning, if you go out and find your front yard has a giant stack of wood that hasn't been chopped yet, you could respond to that in a whole lot of different ways. One thing you could do is just panic and go back to bed. And that's a strong possibility with a lot of folks and under a lot of circumstances. But the real answer is the only thing you can really do about it is take it one piece at a time and chop it and to come up with an effective way to do that. In its simplest terms, that's what the court is attempting to do with this backlog of cases. And the greater, you know, my biggest concern is that we will end up with a headbutting, with a battle, as opposed to a process that creates notice and opportunity to be heard and a clear way to get these things done. And lawyers aren't famous for making complicated things simple. They're more famous for making simple things complicated. And that's always the worry in any process like this. I thank you for the question. Vice Chair Keel.
Except it was my impression that the most recognized minds, not present making the list, but the lawyers that we see that are most effective, those are the ones that make the complicated things simple and understandable.
I agree with that wholeheartedly.
Just a few important tweets.
This is my last slide. This relates to our initiatives, some of which we've already covered here. My initial directives when I first took over, there were several. One was that everyone had to come back to work, and then we had to figure out who could work remotely, you know, off-site. And we've gone through that process. Yet another thing I've done that makes me very popular with folks. But we managed that process. And then the second thing I did was create a new deputy, the training and development deputy. And that initiative, I think, has been extraordinarily successful, actually, having somebody who focuses on recruitment. Just to give you a sense of it, when I first came to the Public Defender Agency, there were routinely 100 applications for every opening. And so 100 people looking for just the one job. And at this point, we just don't live in that same world. And our institutions and structures have taken a while to adjust to that and to recognize that it's no longer a buyer's market when it comes to labor in the legal community. And we have to make ourselves, we have to put ourselves out there, make ourselves desirable, work on recruitment, and have processes that work. And so I think it's been actually quite successful.
Senator Tobin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do want to dig a little bit deeper into the recruitment and the training component. As you've mentioned, Alaska doesn't have a law school. We're hiring a lot of just recently graduated lawyers, and we're struggling with this dynamic of how do we retain them, whether it's a defined benefit reinstatement or some other strategies. And I'd be remiss if I didn't note that the Council of State Governments Justice Center folks behind you mentioned to me that some places have looked at student loan forgiveness or some level of incentive or benefit based on one of those mechanisms. So is there other recommendations that you might have or other things that we in the legislature could be considering in how to give you the tools you need to retain, well, to recruit and then retain folks?
Through the chair, Senator Tobin, I'm always glad when someone asks me if there's something I want, because there's always something I want. You know, ultimately, the question of defined benefit pensions appears to be the third rail of government at the moment in some ways. Not really, but it's a controversial concept and an expensive one. Ideally, would that help with recruitment and retention? Absolutely. But there might be other strategies around that and other benefits that we could talk about as far as how we pay people and how we, you know, how we deal with the retirement issue. And one of them is loan forgiveness. At the moment, although the future is cloudy, at the moment, the federal student loan system seems to occupy that field in large part. In fact, one of the things that we talk about and that we worry about in recruitment is this 10-year moment. You reach 10 years, and folks all of a sudden their loans are forgiven, and the sky's the limit. You know, that's a thing that we deal with. But I do think that loan forgiveness is a thing. You know, as I sit here and think about how things look in Alaska, I think the biggest thing which we needed to do and already did was the increase in salaries to keep pace with what folks get paid around the country. And I think we should continue to look at that going forward as cost of living rises, because I think in some ways we got ourselves here in part by not being quick enough on the draw to keep salaries at pace with what it is around the country. And I think there are lots and lots of things. I think that the training and recruitment question for us and having the deputy do it. Part of it, I think, is just switching the way our bureaucracy works to encourage, like I want lawyers to be able to travel to the places where the law schools are to recruit the students where they're at. You know, I want the ability to do things through social media and advertising and so on and so forth that effectively get the message out that Alaska is the place you want to be. And on the retention side, I want the ability to train our lawyers in a way where they feel supported and have caseloads that they feel are manageable so that they want to stay. This is where they want to be. And those are all things that are, frankly, on me. Like, you know, you've given me the resources to do it, and now we have to do it.
Senator Tobin.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I guess one of the pieces I did know on your website is that you have an internship program for undergraduates, but it is unpaid. And we know with the changing climate and dynamic of some of these programs, there might be an opportunity there to think about how we use that also as a recruiting tool, but in a paid capacity.
Through the chair, Senator Tobin, that's exactly right. There are lots of organizations, both on the defense and prosecution side around the country, who try to come up with ways to incentivize an internship, fellowship, so on and so forth. And you're absolutely right to point that out, and I left it off, but that's actually, I think, something significant we can do. I also think updating our models to what I'm describing as holistic defense, but what is really a way for lawyers to feel a sense of satisfaction in their job, that they're helping people where they're at, that they're not just outsiders who come in as lawyers and kind of invade a situation, fix one problem, and disappear. You know, people really want, I think, and I think it's a good thing. It's a good shift in the way lawyers talk, but I think they want to do more than just that. They want to be part of a solution for people. And the degree to which we can do that, I think, will also improve retention and if we're on the cutting edge of something and doing things that that young lawyers find exciting, they're more likely to come here and more likely to stay here. I've got a little piece here on the misdemeanor training unit that we've already discussed, and which I realize is probably there's probably some controversy in that about taking on the more work. Having tried a few misdemeanor cases, I can say I think it's a tremendous opportunity. I've taken a couple of young lawyers through that process already, and they've had a chance to kind of watch them learning and grappling with the process of becoming a criminal defense attorney, which is no easy thing. The ultimate goal is to have 8 permanent and 4 non-permanent PCNs as part of that. The idea with non-perm positions is that folks would be sort of trying it out in a non-permanent position, and if they demonstrated that it was something they wanted to do and that they were committed, then we would move them in throughout the public defender system into permanent positions, but also presumably some of them off to be AGs and prosecutors and private lawyers. The contract with the city contemplates for FY 2025 $785,000, almost $786,000 that the city would be paying us. And then going forward, the contract contemplates that that as long as case levels stay where they're within about 25% either direction of where they're at now, that it would be a little less than $1.6 million per year. And we calculated that based on what it would cost to operate the program. And so that covers our costs in doing it. It doesn't cover the hard work of training new lawyers and hiring them. But already, I will say, I didn't even expect this level of interest, I will already say that I've had numerous lawyers contact us to say that they would be interested in doing that kind of a program because it affords them the opportunity to be in court and do the work and not feel overwhelmed right out of the gate. So that's my – I thank you guys for the time, I'm happy to take any other questions, but that's what I've got for you.
Senator Myers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Haas, I want to go back to the pretrial delay just a little bit there. We talked about resources and things like that. It seems like and I am glad to see that, you are catching up on cases. We're hearing the same thing from the law and from the courts. I'm concerned with the continuances that's a little bit of a almost a self-fulfilling prophecy that if you request a lot of continuances, not only does it make the trials go longer, but it also means that more cases stack up, which then makes you need more time, so you request more continuances. Is that a problem that you have seen?
Through the chair, Senator Myers, it is. It becomes very complicated for defense attorneys. You probably the members of the committee probably remember an article in the ADM on this topic, several of them. I gave a quote for that article that didn't – the whole thing didn't make it in. But what I said is for a defense attorney, in each instance, the whether to request a continuance or not will be based on the lawyer's assessment of whether that benefits the client. But, of course, the defense attorney is only one piece of this process. So what's supposed to happen is the defense attorney, if they believe it's advantageous for their client or necessary for them to be effective, they'll ask for the continuance, and then the prosecution would weigh in, and then the judge would have the difficult task of weighing the various interests. You know, is this too much time in the instance of the victim? Is this too many continuances for this case in general? What's missing? What do we need to do? The court should be resolving that. But what happened, and it goes back to the pandemic in some ways, what happened is we turned off the trial machine. And it's kind of like when I was a kid, a friend of mine had a diesel generator, which you had to keep running all the time. And if you let it turn off, it was going to be a tremendous amount of effort to ever get it started up again. That's kind of how trials are in a way. If you turn off trials, which we did during the pandemic of necessity, but if you turn them off, you then have to figure out how to get them started again. And you're going to have a bunch of lawyers who have not experienced the trial system running. We also had an outflux of lawyers at the same time. So then you have a bunch of lawyers who existed at a time when there were not trials going forward, and you're asking them now to get busy trying cases. And what they're going to hear from the system, from the judge, from the ADN, from everybody, they're hearing, get out there and try those cases and do it. Only they've rarely seen it done. And so you have to get it. You have to get the ball rolling so that people see how trials work and the benefit they have. And I think that's tricky and difficult. It's more difficult than a mandate or an order or a speech or anything. It's like these individual lawyers have to see the benefit of trial. Because the thing about criminal justice for attorneys is that the trial sets the gold standard. That's how we figure out the economics of a criminal case. What is it worth? What would the judge give me? What is the likelihood that I get an acquittal? What is the likelihood that I get a conviction but do better than this offer? Those kind of questions, those all arise in the environment where the trial is the gold standard. And we stopped doing them. So now we have to start doing them again in order to get that information.
Senator Myers.
Thank you. Just a follow-up on that. Mr. Haas, if I remember right, you were appointed in 2021, I think?
It gets complicated because I was appointed and then confirmed later.
Okay. My point to that is I don't want to beat you up over things that happened before you took the job, basically. But it's my understanding that while COVID exacerbated the trial delays and almost everything related to trials, it was an underlying problem long before that, though, and it had been going on for a while. And so I get concerned when folks start to say, well, it's because of COVID. I understand that restarting that machine can be difficult, but I'm concerned if pre-COVID is our standard that we're looking at. It's my understanding that it was already a problem before then.
Through the chair, Senator Myers, first of all, I've discovered it's my job to get beat up for the decisions before. you have a very good point, which is that there was a developing problem leading up to the mm-hmm. pandemic, where over time, if you were to look at a chart concerning trial delay, and it's funny, when I first got to the public defender, I looked up a report that we happened to have in our files from, I want to say, 1978. And the problems in that report virtually mirror the problems that I'm here talking to you about today, which is just to give you a sense in the long scheme of things over time, always we're going to have to worry about trial delay and about the need to keep cases moving forward. And there was beginning to be a significant problem. It's not that the pandemic caused it. It's that it caused me an administrative difficulty now in addressing it because I have to get more experienced lawyers through more trials so that they understand when and how to behave.
Okay.
I hope that helps.
Yeah.
Just a couple of questions on the last slide. You talk about receipt authority. I assume you have the receipt authority today, or do you need some
authorization? I do not yet. I'm working through the executive branch process and still communicating with my administration about that. So I don't believe that it's in any budget at this time.
That doesn't require legislation. It just needs the receipt authority to show up in our budget documents in some form or another.
I think that's right. Yes, okay. And I want to be careful. I don't understand the budget process well enough to speak intelligently to exactly how that would happen.
We have Senator Keel here, who's on the Finance Committee. He could illuminate it. Is that basically the process they need to go to get the receipt authority?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The public defender has cited to the statute that allows him to do the thing, but the authority to receive and expend the money does need to go into the budget. So actively working with the Department of Administration on FY26 and with the co-chairs on the 25 supplemental, which is a more complicated question in terms of our internal processes.
Okay. But there's not separate legislation.
Nope.
It's all a finance matter.
Yep.
And then the second question I had in connection with the misdemeanor unit, the 8 permanent and 4 non-permanent, that effectively is 12 PCNs. It's just that one of the – if you got hired to the non-permanent, you would be – it's a different set of benefits that come with the non-permanent.
That's right.
And so there would be positions that we would be hired to the non-permanent and know that at some point you're going to leave this job to go to wherever. That might be within the agency. That might be leaving for private practice.
Yeah, thank you for the question, Senator. We're always trying to describe everything as a benefit. So the benefit of being in a non-permanent position is that you get the opportunity to try the work out and that you're also in a position to move into a permanent position as soon as it opens, as long as it's working out.
And I recall there's, and I think I've seen it in both defense and prosecution in some of our larger cities in which the criminal prosecution and defense will work with some of the private firms essentially to create it's kind of like a one-year internship. You're going to go do trials for a year, and then at the end of the year you'll go into work for the private firm, but the benefit somebody gets is actual real-life trial experience as you're describing, but there's not an expectation that they'll be there forever.
I think that's right, Senator, and I appreciate the question because what it really points to is that we're looking for ways to be creative and to borrow strategies and solutions wherever we see them.
I don't see any other questions from members of the committee. So I want to thank you very much for coming to Juneau. When we first talked, I thought you would be virtually here, and it's an improvement over the virtual option.
I always say I remember when virtual meant almost but not quite, so I figured I would come.
I want to thank you very much for the time. We're going to adjourn for the day. Our next meeting will be on Friday, April 11th at 1:30 p.m. We will be having a second hearings on two bills, Senate Bill 78, Wage Disclosure Information, sponsored by Senator Dunbar, and Senate Bill 9, Surrender of Infant Safety Device, sponsored by Senator Meyer. And that, with that, we will stand adjourned. The time is now 2:29 p.m.